Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled The Future of U.S.-Iran Policy. Our panelists today are Elliot Abrams and Brian Katulis. Elliot is Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. He served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Deputy National Security Advisor in the administration of President George Bush, where he supervised U.S. policy in the Middle East for the White House, and a special representative for Iran and Venezuela in the administration of President Donald Trump. Brian Katulis is Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Middle East Institute. He's formerly a Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he built the Center's Middle East program and also worked on broader issues related to U.S. national security. His past experience includes work at the National Security Council and the U.S. Departments of State and Defense. Our moderator today is Professor Jamil Jaffer. Jamil currently serves as founder and executive director of the National Security Institute, as an assistant professor of law and director of the National Security Law and Policy Program at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderators, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speakers give their presentations, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Jamil, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Awesome. Well, Caroline, thanks for having us here today. And Elliot and Brian, thanks to both of you for being here and being part of this conversation. What I thought we'd do today, folks, is we'll talk a little about the situation that's going on right now in the Middle East, in particular in Iran, what implications that might have for U.S. policy, start a conversation between Brian and Elliot about these important issues, and then engage you guys in a conversation about that as well. So have your questions ready at the end of this hour that we've got together, maybe the last 15, 20 minutes. We'll take your questions as well. So feel free to go ahead and put those in the Q&A function in the webinar, and we'll get to those towards the end. But Elliot, let me start with you. Look, you have a long experience in this region. You have long experience dealing with the Iran threat, and in particular, working with President Trump in his prior administration when you focused on these issues as a special representative with respect to Iran and Venezuela. So let's talk about what's going on right now when it comes to the Iran dynamic. Obviously, Iran has suffered massive setbacks post October 7th with the war in Gaza. Israel has been wildly successful in targeting Hezbollah, taking out senior leaders of Hezbollah, taking out senior Hamas leaders, taking out senior Iranian IRGC leaders as well, including the killing of a senior Hamas leader in a IRGC guest house in Tehran. So there have been massive counterterrorism successes. At the same time, Israel's taken out a significant portion of Iran's air defenses after they launched attacks on Israel. Syria's air defenses are also gone now post the fall of the Assad regime. So there is a clear path if Prime Minister Netanyahu wants to go after the Iranian nuclear program. So I guess my first question for you is, do we think that an attack on the Iranian nuclear program is imminent? If it is that an attack that the U.S. would support? And if so, will the U.S. try to provide capabilities like the massive ordnance penetrator, which of course only flies on certain platforms, the B-1, the B-2, the B-52? If it's going to provide it, how would it do it? Would the U.S. actually use that capability? And beyond all of that, you've got President Trump, obviously, talking about what's going on in Gaza. We'll put that to one side for a second. President Trump also talking about a verifiable nuclear agreement with Iran. What does that mean? What does that look like? Is that like the JCPOA, but better that President Obama entered into? What is President Trump talking about? And is this a sign that maybe an attack is not imminent and that, in fact, President Trump wants to do a deal here? Elio, over to you.
Well, thanks, Jamil. And it's great to see Ryan. I think you got to start by remembering Trump's first term, maximum pressure. Why? To what end? He always wanted a negotiation. The purpose of the maximum pressure campaign was not regime change. It was to force them into a negotiation that he argued would produce a better deal than he thought the Obama deal, the JCPOA, was. I think that's still his view. Now, he said categorically this week, they can't have a nuclear weapon. But he has also said, and now Netanyahu has said, the best way to get there is diplomacy. The best way to get there is a deal. If the deal fails, if there is no deal, they still can't be permitted a nuclear weapon. And then you get to the question of, well, would Israel act? Would we act? Would we potentially act together? I think Trump, on the basis of what he said this week, genuinely cannot permit them to get a nuclear weapon. And if he received intelligence, for example, that they had decided their national position was weakening and they had to have a nuclear weapon and they were racing toward it as fast as they could, then I think he would act. I think he would act voluntarily, but he doesn't want to. He wants a deal. The term he uses is verifiable. What we talked about was, first of all, it wouldn't be time limited. It wouldn't last 5 or 10 years. It'd be permanent. Second, it would require, and here you get to verifiable, it would require lots and lots of IAEA access, International Atomic Energy Agency, which has been, once Trump left the JCPOA, access was quite limited, and you've got a long series of statements now by the head of the IAEA saying, you know, they're off to the races. I mean, I don't have full visibility of this, but I can tell they're enriching a lot more uranium to higher levels, certainly to 60%, which, as he said, no country has ever done. No country has ever enriched to 60% and not gone on to build a nuclear weapon. The other thing that Trump wants is comprehensive in the sense that, and he has said it this week, not just nukes. It's got to involve their missile program too. And it's got to involve, you know, the proxies. That is, you can't have a situation where we're in a deal with them, sanctions are gone, and they're using the money to give to Hamas and Hezbollah and Houthis and so on. So that's the deal he wants. Separate question, which we should get to later, I think, is how likely, possible, realistic is such a comprehensive deal?
Well, obviously, a deal like that looks very different than the JCPOA, which explicitly didn't deal with the ballistic missiles question. In fact, I probably gave Iran more room on ballistic missiles than ever before. Didn't touch the proxy question at all as well, focused primarily on uranium enrichment, and actually gave Iran a lot more room than we might have expected on that as well. So it's probably a much harder deal to get to than the JCPOA, which itself was a challenge. And so, Brian, I want to turn to you. You've recently written on these issues. You've written on the question of the U.S. and Iran and on nuclear questions as well. Talk to us about your recent paper and talk to us about what you make of the current situation, what you make of Elliott's assessment that what Trump really wants is a deal and that all the rest of this is sort of an effort to get to a deal, whether it's the pressure on Iran when it comes to going back to maximum pressure and whether he'll do that. And then what that deal looks like. Is it what Elliott's laid out or something different?
Thanks for having me, Jamil, and it's great to be with Elliott. I don't disagree with a lot of what Elliott has to say here. The paper we put out in January with my colleagues Alex Vitanka and Patricia Cottom basically looks at the regional landscape, which is often overlooked when you're looking at the nuclear file or other issues. And the point is pretty simple. The title of the paper is Beyond Maximum Pressure, and by that, we're not opposed to maximum pressure. I actually think it's important to use as much leverage as we can to shape the calculus of the regime. Essentially, we had two critiques of previous administration's policies, from George W. Bush all the way to Biden. That includes Obama and Trump. One was one that Elliott already mentioned, is that we didn't really deal with these regional proxy issues and the threats that Iran poses, and still poses, though it's much diminished these days. And then second, and what the paper really draws out, is that if Trump wants to succeed, if he goes down this pathway of diplomacy, he'd be wise to actually synchronize as best as possible with those countries in the region that are our partners. Here we're talking about not only Israel, obviously Israel would be at the top of that list, but some of these Gulf countries. And the landscape is much changed from when Trump was last in office in 2021. You already mentioned the October 7th war between Israel and Hamas. Essentially, Israel has come close to restoring some semblance zones of strategic deterrence. That's important. I think Iran is on its back heels in the region itself, but it's down, but it's not out. It has, in recent years, Iran has created linkages with Russia and China that have grown in interesting and curious ways. But the thing, and again, I was in the Middle East just last week, got back Tuesday night. The thing that strikes me the most that is often not heard here is what I see is this repositioning of some of the Gulf states, many of the Gulf states, when it comes to Iran. Here, I'm not talking about, of course, Qatar or Oman. They were always sort of had more of an accommodationist policy. What I find sort of surprising, and this is what the paper articulates, is Saudi Arabia and the UAE have actually, I think, substantially repositioned themselves, and they do not want to see an escalation. That may change if there's a different posture, and certainly if Iran does rush towards a nuclear weapon. But the clear signals that I've heard on recent trips in those countries and from top officials made it sound like, I joked with one of the Saudi officials, you sound more like Code Pink to me, or Move On, a left-wing group in the United States. They don't want that confrontation. The Operation Prosperity Guardian, the effort that the Biden administration put together, which I don't think was nearly strong enough to deal with the Houthis in the Red Sea, only Bahrain lined up with it. So the main point of this is that in this sort of new complicated regional landscape, and in the context of a Trump administration 2.0 that does not want to carry so much of a burden, wants others to pull their weights, would they be wise to actually at least more extensively consult those regional partners? We didn't have that for two decades. We had the P5+1 framework, an international framework. That's not going to be recreated. So basically build some form of more concerted cooperation on the military issues, but also diplomatically if you're going to engage Iran.
Yeah. What about that, Elliot? I mean, are you hearing the same thing from the GCC countries, and in particular UAE and Saudi Arabia? Do you get the sense that they're more open to some sort of a broader deal with Iran and wanting to avoid a significant conflict here? You know, they've often been amongst the most hawkish and most concerned about Iran's nuclear program, as concerned as Israel. And so talk to us about how you see that dynamic going. Is there an opportunity here to build a coalition? And if so, what does that coalition look like, and what are their goals? I mean, do they want this verifiable nuclear deal that Trump is looking for? And again, I want to come back to this idea that there is a verifiable nuclear deal that can address the proxy issues, that can address the ballistic missile issues. I mean, is there any chance that Iran wants to get to a deal, or is willing to get to a deal that looks anything like that?
Well, let me start with the neighbors, the Gulf Arabs, basically. Here we are, 10 minutes in, I'm already going to get partisan. Sorry. But I think that's a reaction in part to the weakness of Biden Middle East policy, but also Trump Middle East policy in the first term. What was the U.S. reaction when Iran attacked the main Saudi oil complex, petroleum complex, petrochemicals, ABQ? They attacked it directly. We didn't do anything. Same thing with the Emirates. So
zero.
I think when you see, for example, the Saudis making nice with Iran, courtesy of China in Beijing, I think what they're doing is what any of us would do. That is, they're saying, well, the Iranians are dangerous. If the Americans are not in this, if they're not going to protect me, my best option is see if I can lower the level of hostility. So let's talk. I don't think that tells you what they would do if there was a really strong U.S. policy, but we haven't had one. So they're kind of hedging their bets. Let's put it that way. Now, can we get that agreement, that comprehensive agreement? I'm really dubious. And the reason I say it is, well, I have a friend who's an Iran expert who says, what are the pillars of this regime, the Islamic Republic? Death to America, death to Israel, and repression of women, the hijab. A comprehensive deal would be asking them to give up at least the first two. It would not only be no nuclear weapons, no intercontinental ballistic missiles, it would be, and lots of inspections, it would be knock off the death to Israel stuff, knock off the money and guns to Houthis and Hamas and Hezbollah and Shia militias in Iraq. Just become a normal country. Remember the Kissinger phrase, like 30 years ago, you know, they have to decide whether they want to be a country or a cause. Are they really willing to do that? Do we think the Ayatollah, now 85, in his last years, not in great health, is willing to kind of start turning the country away from the Islamic revolution and toward being a normal country? I don't think so. So I think Trump is right to try to negotiate, but I think he needs to worry a lot about being, you know, pulled into a never-ending negotiation that goes nowhere and whose main purpose is just to prevent Israel or the United States from taking military action. At the end of the road, I don't see it.
So, Jamil, can I just say,
No, please.
Yeah, Elliot's windup that he was going to be partisan, but then his delivery it was underwhelming to me because he actually then issued a critique of the administration that he served in, the Trump administration. And that's sort of a point I've made all along. And I heard it just even last week, which is alarming to me. I know it's early returns on the Trump 2.0 administration, but I did talk to a lot of people at a conference that was hosted by an Indian think tank in Abu Dhabi. And there were many people from across the region, including from Tehran. And what was most alarming to me was how the different voices from across the Gulf region were reading the Trump administration 2.0. Number one, first, consumed by a lot of its own internal issues and different challenges. Number two, the fact that the moves that he made, Brian Hook being dismissed from the Wilson Center board on the first day, or more importantly, I think this is a very serious security question. Some people from Tehran taking, analyzing Trump's move to remove security from the people that were behind the Qasem Soleimani attack, being, I think, misperceived. I tried to dissuade him of this as some sort of sign of weakness and things like this. But the thing I would say is that the fact that the United States has not been seen to have a steady policy and steady approach by these partners has, as Elliot said correctly, led them to hedge. Still too early to say in the Trump administration where this is all going. But things like, this may sound far afield, the freeze of foreign aid that actually impacts directly the battlefield in places like Syria, or the potential to seize the opportunity in Lebanon now that Hezbollah is down but not out. All of these things, I think, are watched very, very carefully by our friends and our adversaries alike. And I think the early sense is that this is an administration that, though it has EOs and has signed certain things, does not have a strategic focus at all. And then I think you add to it some of the stuff, we won't get into it, on the Arab-Israel front, just looks a little goofy and clownish to the region.
Well, so what about that, Elliot? I mean, this idea that if you don't think that there's a real deal to be had, why would Trump want to negotiate? If the real advice he's getting is Iran's never going to do a deal like this, they're never going to give you what you want, why even put a deal on the table? And then if you do put a deal on the table and it doesn't go anywhere, don't you run into the problem that Brian's raising, which is this question of A, you're talking about doing a deal you know is unrealistic. B, we're waving a big stick, but not really willing to use it because you don't actually want to get in a war with Iran. Your allies want to get in a war with Iran, right? And they're Finlandizing perhaps towards China and making some sort of a deal. How do you, I mean, at the end of the day, if the problem is a consistent weak U.S. policy on Iran, maximum pressure being the one exception to that, right? And the economic pressure being the exception to that. And of course, the old congressionally imposed sanctions and the Obama administration that the Obama administration fought and then claimed to work with Congress on. What is the right play? If you were once again running Iran policy and the president was listening to you and you told him what to do and he did exactly as you said, what would the next step be and how would you get to that vaunted, maybe mystical deal?
The first step would be maximum pressure. It would be a return to that and a clear statement about preventing them from getting a nuclear weapon. Now, he's done both of those things. I mean, obviously, maximum pressure doesn't happen overnight, but he has issued the instruction that's going to be our policy. And he said the right words about the nuke. I would say he needs to enforce the sanctions, which the Biden administration did not do. Again, the language from Trump, from the executive order, is very good. You know, ships and insurance companies and banks and everybody. But you have to do it. And you have to take a few examples. of where you have actually indicted someone or cut someone off from the U.S. banking system or blacklisted a shipping company, then it gets serious. And then, it'll have a real effect. I would also like to see him order some exercises, military exercises, that show us preparing for an Iran strike, that say to the Iranians, look, it's going to be your choice. You're going to do this deal and walk away from your nuclear weapons program, or you're going to decide to brazen it out. And if you do that, you're going to get hit.
Yeah.
We've done some of that over, I would say, the Trump years and the Biden years. There have been some exercises. But I'd like to see that again. You raised the question about Israel. Trump doesn't want war anywhere. He wants to put an end to the Gaza war. He wants to put an end to the Ukraine war. He was willing to do the Soleimani strike. And I think he, like, I would say President Obama, likes the idea that, it's over when you announce it. You go on TV and you say, now, last night, no 10-year wars, no 5-year wars. Right. I think the debate in the Oval Office, if we get to it, is going to be between people in the administration who say, this is going to be Iraq and Afghanistan again. This is going to go on and on. You can start it. You can't end it. And those who say it's a day or two. If in those circumstances he comes out for doing nothing, then the Israelis will act. I don't myself see us giving them, B-2s or B-52s.
Right.
I can see us giving them tankers, that sort of thing. But I've always believed that, they would be able to do some damage to the Iranian program from the air and on the ground. They obviously have some kind of ground capability. We've seen them exercise it in espionage and in assassinations. It's clear that we could do, 25 times more than they could. I can't predict where Trump comes out in that situation if we get to it.
Brian, what do you make of that? I mean, do you think that the right, do you think that Trump makes the move? There's not a deal to be had. Does he work with the Israelis on an attack against the program? And if so, do we actually undertake it? Do they do it on their own? And is that the right call? What's the right call if, in fact, a deal that addresses the proxy problem is not something you can get to with Iran, no matter how much maximum pressure you put on them? They're simply unwilling to negotiate those issues. What would you do, Brian, if that were end up being the scenario?
Well, I would be doing more right now on this proxy problem and showing more force and face in the region with our partners. And that's
like going after the Houthis,
Oh, absolutely. And I think we've had a policy of passive appeasement in the region for decades, going back to when the George W. Bush administration invaded Iraq, and then we had hundreds of soldiers being killed by Iranian-backed militias.
Yeah,
we
just the top Hezbollah, Ansar al-Haq.
Yeah, we have this weird sort of discourse in the United States, and I used to engage in it myself when I was at the Center for American Progress earlier in my career, where automatically it's almost knee-jerk, well, we can't do that because it'll be like the Iraq war again. And no, it's not like that. And it's actually that sort of dialogue that puts us in this sort of passive appeasement approach. I really think it's a mixed picture. I mean, the fact that Elliot Abrams, who I really respect, is here on this webinar with me and not in the administration like it was in the first Trump administration gives me a lot of concern about how strong Trump himself will be. Because if you talk to the people like I do, and I have friends on the Republican side of things, the lineup is very, very, very much mixed. Start at the top with Trump. He says many different things, and it's, you spend your whole day actually fielding press requests trying to interpret what he meant on Gaza and other things. It's unclear. But with Mike Waltz and Marco Rubio, you have fairly hawkish individuals in key positions. Rubio, of course, has his own minder, as we've learned from the press, from the Trump campaign and sort of the Tucker Carlson, Don Jr. Camp, which is, I don't think, very hawkish on Iran. What I picked up out in the region on this last trip is that they are the ones who are actually talking about continued de-escalation. J.D. Vance is certainly in that camp, a week before the election, he was on a podcast saying, look, we don't want to go to war with Iran. This should be the Israelis and the Sunni nations, as he called it, getting together. And my point on the paper is good luck doing that, because their posture is actually quite different. And then you go over to the Pentagon, Elbridge Colby, I would recommend his podcast with Tucker Carlson, his interview right after the election. He's definitely not in this camp as I read it. And the Dasty, whom I don't know, but the readings that I've seen of pieces he's put out, the Dasty for the Middle East, essentially said we shouldn't be, should not be bombing the Houthis. So it's a very mixed picture. And and if you add Tulsi Gabbard to the mix as the director of national intelligence, who will be charged with actually then producing the intelligence on all of these things related to Iran. If you look at her record as a Democratic congresswoman, who, as I myself as a Democrat, didn't consider her as anywhere close to mainstream. We're in a very different landscape inside the Trump administration, but Trump's his own man, as I think Elliot will attest to. He'll decide this based on how he sees it. But I think his inclination is to rail against endless wars without actually investing the necessary, and this is my main point here, the U.S. actually needs to deepen its engagement in the Middle East to actually send those signals to Iran. I think the Biden team was weak. It stepped up, but it was too reactive to the plays that Iran was playing. Now that Iran's on its back foot, we're going to unilaterally disarm ourselves by freeing aid, disengaging from Syria, not engaging properly in Lebanon. And this is a formula for Iran to actually build back better its regional proxy network.
Yeah, Elliot, I mean, that does seem like a problem. The Trump administration does seem at war with itself when it comes to whether it's Iran policy or Taiwan policy. You've got people on both sides. You've got a lot of folks from the Queen's Institute, you know, and defense priorities who think that we should just disarm and retreat back home. You know, what do you make of that dynamic within the administration? You've got, obviously, people are very strong on Iran and Taiwan, Marco Rubio, Mike Waltz, to Brian's point. But you've got a lot of people at DOD and now coming into the IC that are not of that orientation. And the president himself doesn't appear to be necessarily in that place either. So what do we do about that fact? And how do our adversaries read that situation? Are they reading the tea leaves and say, well, he's going to talk big, but he's actually going to bring it, and therefore we should call his bluff?
Well, I share the concern. There are a lot of different views in the administration. When you talk to people at the top, I don't mean the president, but say cabinet secretaries, you know, the answer you tend to get is, I'm in charge. I know what the policy is. I know what the president wants. I know what I want. Don't worry about it. That's a very bad answer, because these are mammoth bureaucracies. You know, think of take the Secretary of Defense. Think of everything on his plate. The Middle East is one part of it. He can't watch that all day long. There's only one person who can all day long, and that's the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. And that, you know, from everything I received, happens to be someone I don't know, but from what one reads in the paper, his views and those of the Secretary and the President are not aligned. So I do worry about this. And, you know, the president seems to like it. You know, the idea that people come to him and they'll fight it out and then he gets to decide. But it can lead to policies that are not coherent. So, you know, look, we're 2 weeks in. A lot of posts are still vacant. For example, Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East. Nobody. So Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. So, you know, there's a lot yet to kind of develop in a 2-week-old administration. But I think what happened here is that last time, 8 years ago, Trump ran and didn't think he'd win, and he wasn't prepared to win. So what do you do in that situation? He relied on two groups of people, basically, the Republican Party national security officials and generals. This time, he's not doing that. This time, he's got his own kind of MAGA group. There are others in it. I mean, that certainly is not a fair description of Rubio.
Right.
But that group exists, and there's a lot of people being hired with, I'd say, less experience than 8 years ago. And, you know, it is going to be a battle. One of the players in that battle ought to be mentioned, or one of the potential players. There is a thing called Congress.
Yeah.
I am struck.
I'm not sure they know that, by the way, Elliot. I'm not sure they know they have a role to play.
It's a long-term trend, right? Congress has been handing off power to the executive branch and regulatory agencies, well, since Woodrow Wilson. It has been striking. I think it's fair to say on a number of nominees, without giving my own personal view, there are a number of nominees who you know would have been opposed by virtually every Republican had they been appointed by Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And they're just going along with the president on this because they don't want trouble.
So Brian, what about that? What is all what Elliot's laid out, this sort of internal battle, you laid it out as well, between inside the administration? What does that say to our allies? You were over there, they're watching it closely as you laid out. What do they feel is that cause them to Finlandize in the way that both you and Elliot were talking about, to, you know, a more accommodationist policy towards Iran, you know, towards sort of China playing a bigger role, Russia playing a bigger role in the region? Or are they still looking to see, will there be actual strength here? And maybe this, you know, sort of team of rivals approach that Trump has, or, you know, running it like the Apprentice approach might actually.
Yeah, I think they look to the United States, these countries that have been in our camp, as the preferred strategic partner of choice. They don't want to go to China. They certainly don't feel like they want to be with Russia. They know we have the strongest capabilities, but they see the internal divisions. And this is where a lot of what's going on right now, that it consumes America and the things that are being done to national security institutions that are about projecting power. And it's only started with USAID, but it'll sort of go down the line to the intelligence agencies and the State Department quite soon. They read this very carefully, and they see the internal divisions. I mean, I can't tell you how much January 6th in these monarchies that are autocratic, they see sort of the chaos and the disarray and the violence and other things. And even the pardons, people talked about the pardoning of, and these are countries that a lot of them don't have rule of law. So there's an irony there, but they essentially see an America that's very much at war with itself. But nonetheless, they still hope that we'll have their back. But I think the experience of not just the Obama administration especially, but then the incidents in the Trump administration, notwithstanding the Qasem Soleimani strike, a number of things like upcakes, people still talk about the lack of a response. Now, go back to a thing I said earlier, Israel actually, in reaction to being attacked in this vicious attack by Hamas on October 7th, has restored a semblance of strategic deterrence. And to me, the real play, I mean, the nuclear issue is the urgent question, but the thing that we should be doing right now is on the ground in all of the theaters, the key theaters that are contested, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen in particular. And it's not clear to me that the Biden team had a very strong strategy for these places. We were sort of going along and giving a boost to Israel, though pulling back the reins at certain points on theaters like Lebanon. But I don't know that the Trump team, as I see it, will coalesce around a clear approach. Let me say something about Congress. And again, this is my screaming into the wind. I actually think October 7th and the role of Iran in backing that, but also Iran attacking Israel twice last year, and that was very constrained. But the fact that U.S. engagement and the investments that were made over several U.S. administrations, to build a security network that actually left those the impact of that on us and on Israel and our allies quite constrained. I actually think that was a worthwhile investment. And I think it also was a wake-up call for more moderate centrist Democrats, internationalists, and the Republican Party. I actually think if we had real leadership, which we don't on these issues in Congress, I mean, we have some voices, but it's not what it used to be. Too many of the internationalist voices, like a Lindsey Graham, who used to be with John McCain, but I think is very much chameleon-like. And and I don't, you know, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. He just shapeshifts like a lot of politicians do on these issues. Because we lack that sort of vital center, I actually think Iran reads that, our adversary Iran reads that, but then our partners in the region read that, and it's going to prompt them at every step of the way. And I know Israel, Palestine, Israel, Arab is considered separate, but these visits by King Abdullah and President Sisi next week to talk about, I assume, mostly the Gaza question, that's not how it's viewed. It's not viewed as separate files when you're sitting there in the Gulf. And that's where, if we don't sound like we're serious, if we sound like we're coming up with goofy ideas that aren't, that don't have buy-in from the region, and also try to bridge this gap and create the opportunity for Israel to integrate with the region, we're just going to seem erratic as ever, but in many different ways. And that's my worry.
I would just like to add that there are probably huge divisions in Tehran. I mean, there are going to be people in Tehran now saying, look, the overall situation in the region has turned against us. Gaza, but even more particularly Lebanon, Syria. We need a nuclear weapon. And there will be others there who will say, you're going to bring the Americans into this. You don't think they'll bomb, but they will. This could be, you know, a big American bombing for a couple of days could be the end of the whole. All of us could be gone. And I think those debates actually are underway. They're taking place again. You know, these are the last years of the Ayatollah Khamenei.
Yeah.
I mean, we can't say exactly when, but he's 85 and he's not well. So he's got to make this decision about, you know, what am I leaving behind? And obviously we want to, you know, we want to push him very much in the direction that, man, you rush for a nuclear weapon, it will be the last thing you do.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I should say, on the sidelines of this conference in Abu Dhabi, I bumped into what I thought were some of the more hardliners, and I referred to them already, how they were, I think, misreading the tea leaves of how Trump was removing security for some of his former officials. But they were feeling a little bit more bullish. America's distracted. It's got its own problems. I went to Oman, and I didn't meet any people from Iran there. But the Omanis, of course, are offering. They're really, you know, people in Tehran are desperate to talk. And those two sort of data points showed to me, and it reaffirms what you're saying, Elliot, there's a debate inside of Iranian society. And so long as in these early stages, and I know it takes a while for a team to get its act together and get the people in the slots and things like this, but if you're sending so many mixed signals, it actually then reinforces, it doesn't do anything to shape that debate in any way. It doesn't shape their calculus. And that could be a missed opportunity right now to reinforce the sense of loss that Iran has faced in the region, and that they're weak at this point. Don't let them build back. If you want to start a conversation.
So I do want to go to the audience for questions. And so audience members, we're going to open it up for you to ask questions here in the next few minutes or so. So just keep an eye on the Q&A function. Go ahead and put any questions that you have in there. But I do want to come back to something that Brian said earlier, Elliot, which is this idea that the sort of the chaos that's going on right now within the administration, put aside the January 6th pardon, which are themselves, you know, a challenge, but the stuff that's happening at the Justice Department, the FBI, buyouts being offered to CIA, all of USAID being recalled to the United States, terminations of funding for foreign aid programs, at least for 90 days. These are all sending signals as well to our allies and our adversaries around the globe. And one that may not be perceived as positive now, the administration has in theory got a plan for what they're trying to do. They're trying to cut government programs and the like. But what about that? Is that undermining our ability to be successful, both in telling our adversaries we're going to be a real opponent and telling our allies we're going to be there for you when you need us? Is this a problem? How big a problem is it? Because I think there's a perception it's a massive problem. Is that true, or is it less of a problem than people might?
I'm inclined toward the latter. That is, people know, first of all, in any administration, it takes you months to get people in place. Might be 3 months, might be 6 months. And I think they know there's an element of confusion in the early days anyway. But I think they know that, you know, Trump is not going to react well to defeats, to humiliations, to losses. And if they think they're going to impose those on him, there could be a pretty strong reaction. So I'm, you know, I we get to the substance of some of these things, but, you know, do I think that it's sensible to put AID under the State Department? Yeah, you know, the British did it about 5 years ago. They put BFID under the FCO, which is now the FCD for development, FCDO. Do I think that the staff of AID is predominantly Democrats who don't like Trump and who have done a lot of programs that Americans would not support? Yeah. Yeah, I do. Now, the answer is not to destroy the agency. The answer is to improve the agency. But it needs improvement. It really needs improvement. I would say the same thing about the FBI. I think going after low-level FBI agents is a terrible idea for national security reasons, for reasons of fairness. But I think we saw during the Biden years that the top levels of the FBI were riddled with people willing to use their official power for partisan purposes. And Trump was a loser in that. There are probably some people there who should go. So, just one more example, Jamil, one close to your heart, I think.
Yeah.
51 leaders of the intelligence community 8 years ago signed, 4 years ago, signed this claim that the Hunter Biden laptop looked like a Russian disinformation move. I know some of those people. I thought the world of those people. I don't understand how they lent themselves to such an obvious political ploy. Lent themselves, their reputations, the name of the CIA. That should never happen again. People who did that had their security clearances lifted. Most of them retired now. You know, my reaction was, good, maybe it's a lesson for people. Try to stay out of politics if you're a career employee of the CIA.
Yeah, Brian, I want to give you a chance to respond to that, and then I've got questions from the audience.
I agree with that completely, but what I think is happening is potentially qualitatively different than what Elliot describes here. It's not simply making sure that there are loyalists at the top and people not trying to undermine the agenda. This is not, if you remember the Malik manual from the Nixon administration, the Fred Malik, there's something quite different going on here. If you look at who was named at least to be the deputy director of the CIA and his reputation, even within the first Trump administration and those circles, and whether he was professional or not, somebody who worked with Devin Nunes. So there is a process that's underway that it has been, some of it's been reported in the press, but is Stasi-like inside of a lot of these organizations. And the problem with that is, yes, I do think the president deserves people who want to implement his agenda, but there are certain moves that are being made over at DOJ. You would know better about all of that. That actually, I think, move towards making us less capable of implementing our national security agenda. There are some really good people who I know very well, who just simply want to serve the public and have served multiple administrations. And they're now looking at who's coming in, and then importantly, how they're dealing with career people who have served multiple administrations, Republican and Democrat. And they're essentially being asked loyalty tests. They're essentially asking themselves, am I actually going to be able to serve public and the national security interests of this country, or am I being asked to actually do something different? And that may sound a little melodramatic, but I think as we see the next few weeks and months unfold, this may become more apparent as the stories come out more of who actually is being put in charge of different files. And then whether, and this is the key point I want to stress, not to be partisan, and I don't think people who had the privilege of serving in the senior positions should operate in the way that Elliot described in that letter. But people who actually, I think, have essential skills and capacities that are essentially asked to leave because they're perceived in some sort of way to not actually fit with the mold of this new administration, and it may actually make us less safe.
Yeah, look, I'm obviously deeply concerned about us targeting, you know, line FBI agents who simply are doing their jobs and being asked to investigate things and now are being tarred potentially with a feather brush. That's obviously hugely problematic. I do happen to know Michael Ellis, the deputy director, the new named deputy director of CIA, and I actually don't necessarily agree with that characterization of his capability or skill set or the kind of person he is. But putting that to one side, let's take some questions from the audience. Michael Lippin wants to, from VOA, asked a question about this memorandum that President Trump has issued. issued about preventing the Gulf states from being used for sanctions invasion, or Iraq in particular. How is this new compared to prior administration policies from the Trump administration? I'll ask you that, Elliot. And then, Brian, maybe you could tell us how that is, whether that effort to try and prevent the Middle Eastern states from being used for sanctions invasion is different from what Biden did. So over to you, Elliot.
You know, I think we always tried to do that. I mean, this, I don't know if it was ever in an executive order, but clearly, you know, if you're trying to do a maximum pressure campaign, you're looking at the ways that they go around it. And I do remember, for example, there were points at which we said to the Emiratis, look, Dubai is being used by the Iranians to get around sanctions. Close it down. Obviously, this has been a big problem with Iraq, because the Iran uses every, you know, opportunity that it can find. So I don't think this is new. They may be giving it a little more public attention.
Anything else on that for you, Brian?
I think that's right. I don't think that's new. I know there were ongoing efforts. I think the Biden team, frankly, they tried to renegotiate the JCPOA for 2 years. But then I think they had a tacit agreement with the Iranians to essentially allow them to bust sanctions so long as they didn't go after us strongly. That was not a very good deal. They kept on going after our troops, and their proxies attacked Israel for more than a year. But I do think that the main issue right now is whether we have all of the capacities in place. Again, if we're at the start of what I think can be a process driven by Doge and Elon Musk, and I think there's a genuine need to get more efficiencies in government. But if we actually reduce our capacities to do these sorts of things, to actually make sure that our partners are abiding by the sanctions frameworks that we have, we in a sense, this may again be a little melodramatic. We'll see where it all comes out. But I think we may be in an odd way in a period of unilateral disarmament of ourselves and our capacities, especially in the Treasury, State Department, and certainly USAID realms.
So Mark Merowitz asked about what Iran might do to recover from it and Hezbollah ouster in Syria, and I would add to that Lebanon. Is there a comeback path for Iran? Russia's obviously trying to make its way back into Syria, trying to make a deal on Tartus and the like. Is there an opportunity here for Iran to come back? And if so, what might that look like in both Syria and Lebanon when it comes to the defeats it's seen, both with respect to its proxy Assad and Hezbollah there in Lebanon? Brian, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think we just had at the Middle East Institute this morning, my colleagues, Nicholas Nassar and Paul Salem, talk about this from Beirut, is if we don't actually more directly engage with the opportunity, and I don't want to overstate the opportunity because Hezbollah is still there. It's down, but it's not out. Lebanon still has a deeply problematic government, but it has a president, that we need to actually invest in those relationships to actually, for those who are competing with the Hezbollah and Iran proxies in these places. My worry is in the first couple of weeks, the signal that's been sent, or when the Assad regime fell, this was during the transition, both President Trump and J.D. Vance said, essentially, we're going to stay the hell out. Now, I don't think that's what they're actually going to be able to do because of ISIS and other things. But again, if we are not focused on what is our strategy as America to compete with Iran, to work with those who want to actually hold off Iran, and Iraq is a key centerpiece of this. And I think the Iraqi leadership is coming here next week. I'm talking to the ambassador tomorrow. I'll know more about it. But I think half of life is just showing up. And I worry that we won't show up in the Middle East right now.
Elliot, thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are things we can do. I mean, for example, Syria. We should be making very clear to the new government, to President Shara, we're going to judge you by your willingness to interdict Iranian resupply of Hezbollah and Iranian subversion of Jordan through getting weapons in there, too. I think we should be conditioning aid to Lebanon. I think we should say, you have a great opportunity, but if you don't take it, if you go back to the same old spoils system and corrupt politics, we're not giving you any money. So, you know, for example, who is going to be the new cabinet? Will the Lebanese army, in fact, do what it keeps promising to do? Deploy to the south, confront Hezbollah, do not let them rebuild. And, you know,
I wouldn't let breath on that.
Yeah, I'd probably bet against it, but our position's got to be very clearly.
Yeah.
Guys, you have an opportunity. We're willing to let bygones be bygones. Do your job. You rail against the foreigners taking away Lebanese sovereignty. Okay, now's your chance to show to build Lebanese sovereignty. And if you want to do that, we will not only help you directly, we'll make sure the EU, the Saudis, Emiratis, everybody helps you. But if not, not.
Yeah. So Luke Cass has a question. I'll start with you, Elliot, on this one. What's the current state of play between Iran and Iraq? And is there an opportunity for American influence there to maybe exploit a divide or lack of?
The Iraqis have noticed the weakening of Iran's position in the region. And you are seeing some more efforts by Sunnis and by Shia in Iraq to kind of push back a little bit. It seemed, you know, it's plausible to me. It's a little bit like case in Lebanon, but it's harder because the Hezbollah has really been decimated in a way that Iran, an immediate neighbor, and with so many Shia militias dependent on it, has not been in Iraq. So I think, again, I mean, we need to work with the Gulf Arabs to help Iraqis step by step build their sovereignty and push back against Iran, which means that, you know, if we adopt a policy of kind of pulling back from the Middle East, it would be just shameful because there really is an opportunity here, thanks mostly to the Israelis.
Yeah. If I could say, and this is a point we make in this paper, Beyond Maximum Pressure, what Elliot just said in sort of broad strokes, I think is essential. But what I'm seeing in places like Riyadh, and I'm sure you see this too as well, Abu Dhabi and other places, is that these countries are much more assertive in their own self-interest. They don't want to waste their money. They don't want their money to go down a rat hole. So security, I think the first basis is security, is that security presence and making sure that Iran does not threaten us or our partners in places like Iraq or in the Gulf. But then the economic component of that engagement is where I actually think it falls a little thin in the think tank community inside of government and others. And that engagement of buy with and through those countries that actually have the resources, I've heard from Saudis for years now of how they're going to actually deepen their ties inside of Iraq. And it hasn't really happened, but I actually think in this administration, and this is where if Trump sees himself as a deal maker, and this is sort of a bank shot, but it's a way of actually boosting ties between the Gulf and Iraq and bringing Iraq much more into their orbit, because everybody sees the prosperity in most of these Gulf countries and they want a piece of it. But I think a team like Trump 2.0 that doesn't want to spend U.S. taxpayer money or time and attention over there, they actually should look at this economic statecraft component of bringing Iraq closer to the heart of the Middle East, of the Gulf area, in this competition with Iran. And no, it sounds like academic or theoretical, but I actually think it's a place where this administration actually could do a lot of good.
Yeah. Great. Well, appreciate that, Brian Elliott. So I'm going to combine two questions now. We're coming towards the end of our time. So Shari Stemmitz, an anonymous attendee, has questions about the next leader of Iran. So one, who do we think the next leader of Iran might be? How will that person lead? I mean, could the death of the Ayatollah, if it comes in the near future, him being in his 80s, as you point out, Elliot, do you think the death of the Ayatollah could be a catalyst for a strong relationship with the United States? There's a lot of talk about what Iran could do to strengthen ties with the West, but what can the West do to strengthen ties with Iran? And I'll add to that, you know, what about the Iranian public? We've talked a lot about the Iranian leadership, right? We know the Iranian public is much more open to the West than perhaps the leadership is. Is there a chance to exploit that sort of dynamic for the United States? Elliot, I'll start.
Okay, we don't know who the next Supreme Leader is going to be. I do think we can say two things. Khamenei's son, Mojtaba, is a serious candidate, and maybe he gets it. And in a way, that's a good thing because it discredits the Islamic Republic. These are all people who made speeches against the Shah and the idea of royalty and of father-son. The second thing I think we can say is that this country, the Islamic Republic, has really been run by the top cleric in a way that isn't going to be repeated. I think that, let's say, a year from now, Khamenei dies and his son takes the top job, he's going to have to deal with rival groups from a position that isn't really very far above them, if it's above them at all. For example, the Revolutionary Guards. I think their power is going to be greater because there's no supreme leader like Khomeini in the past, Khamenei now, to just sort of say, no, we're doing what I say, be quiet. Which means that I think the notion that we're going to be able to have better relations with Iran is unlikely, because the follow-on leadership may be as radical as this leadership, and it may even be more willing to take risks.
Yeah, Brian, what about?
Yeah, let me talk about the people, because this is a place where I think the United States has fallen short essentially for the last 20, 30 years. A lot of talk, but no good action. Most recently under the Biden administration, when there were protests in the fall of 2022 after the death of Mahsa Amini. And yes, there was performative diplomacy and all of the talk and things like this, but no real rethink of how to actually plant the seeds to support the millions of Iranian people who want freedom. And I know these days, especially in 2025, it is passé to talk about democracy and freedom. But under the Biden administration, he essentially had a big backslide in a place like Afghanistan. And then a few months later, they had the audacity to hold a summit for democracy. And these are issues that Elliot and I have worked on together and I feel strongly about. And same thing under the Trump administration, where essentially there were protests and Mike Pompeo did a few things and wrote an op-ed, but there really wasn't a strategic support there. Coming back to the moment we're in right now, where I really worry about the gutting and cutting that's happening inside, that's about to come, and the potential threats to things like the National Endowment for Democracy. I hope it is preserved. But these are the connective tissues. Like, I worked in it when I worked in the 1990s in the Middle East with the National Democratic Institute and the International Republican Institute. And I know it sounds tactical and not strategic, but it is essential for building the fabric of relationships with folks. And we don't do nearly enough to help the Iranian people poise themselves for that moment of transition. Elliot's right. We don't know who actually will lead Iran when the supreme leader dies. And it'll be a good day when he's gone, right? Because he's not done good for his own people or for the region or the world. But we're doing next to nothing to actually shape the conditions. And I think there's a lot more that can be done. And I fear that we're actually, again, unilaterally disarming ourselves. It's not a new dynamic in this field, but I think we're going to put that on steroids in Trump 2.0.
All right. Well, look, Brian, Elliot, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it. Thank you to the audience for your questions. Apologies, we didn't get to all the questions there. Let me hand it back over to Caroline to wrap up.
Great. Thanks so much, Jamil. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.